Here we go. Well, the first thing and the most important thing, let's see, is I'm disappointed to tell you that I have no relationships. I'm glad I have friends here. Thank goodness. That's why I come to APHA. Anyway, here is the climate change. What's important about climate change, I think, is that it's happening now. This is not something that people are going to just say in the future, oh, you know, it's starting to happen. This is something that's already started to happen. We have seen a large increase in average global temperature. We've seen increasing global air temperature as well as ocean temperature. When I talk to my friends at Scripps, you know, they show me the ocean temperature, and it's very disturbing. We are rising in terms of the global average sea level, and we have startling reductions of snow and ice. In fact, if you'd come to San Diego a few years ago, you know, you would have had to trudge through the snow. The human impact of climate change is evident. If you look at changes in CO2 from samples coring through the ice, and you look at modern data, you can see that global atmospheric concentration of all the greenhouse gases have increased very rapidly as human activity has increased. And in 2005, the concentration of CO2 exceeded by far the natural range over the last couple of years. I consider 650,000 just kind of a couple of years, but some of you might consider it a long time. But if you look, it's very significant to look at how the CO2 levels, and it's very disturbing, and I don't think it's equivocal at all. I'm sure that most of you know that the contributions to greenhouse gas are from fossil fuels, from oil, from natural gas, and from coal, and more than 60% of the annual industrial carbon dioxide emissions come from the so-called industrialized country we together account for about a fifth of the 6.5 billion people on this earth. And while I may not focus on it very much, let's say that we did nothing and that we were able to not increase the amount that we were expending at all per capita. How many additional people will be on this earth on October 27th next year compared to the number that are here now? 750 million additional people. So that is the time bomb, in addition to all the other things that I will talk about. That's the time bomb that is not talked about enough. Maybe it's not politically correct, but it's real. Coming back to the current population, our per capita emissions are over 20 times greater than India, 12 times greater than Brazil, and 7 times higher than China. And these will change significantly. It's true that China's very concerned, and they're very concerned because their GDP growth for the next year might only be 8%. Which is probably, you know, 100 times what it'll be here, if anything. We will probably be in negative territory, but China's worried that it'll only be 8% for reasons I could go into. But India, China, and other countries are developing economically. China is now, overall, because their population is so great, the number one carbon emitter, surpassing the U.S. And we expect that global CO2 emissions will increase by at least 50% over the next 25 years under current conditions. Oops, wrong way. So here are the emissions. You can see the relative contributions in 2005, and you see that the U.S. is in a prominent place, almost a quarter of all the emissions. China, and this is because this is a few years old, was a little behind us at 18%. Russia's working hard to catch up. India and Japan and the rest of EU. And realize that the EU, by the way, has roughly the same population as the United States. And look at the relative carbon monoxide emissions from the EU versus the US of A. And then a third are all the other countries combined. Now, if you look at the CO2 emissions from fossil fuel, it is not surprising that a very substantial amount comes from coal, which is the main way that we generate electricity. But an equal amount, roughly, is from transportation. I'm not going to ask how many people came here via public transportation, but my guess is it's not the vast majority of people in Southern California, for example. I mean, I drove my Prius. I looked at whether I'd be better off taking, and then I'd have to take cabs back and forth, and I decided to take my Prius, and I used 2 gallons of gas coming down here from Los Angeles. But I get 50 miles a gallon, and most people don't do quite that well. If you look here at the industrial base, you can see that most of the industrial base runs on petroleum, with a smaller contribution from coal, and then you can see residential and commercial is petroleum or natural gas. Oops, keep doing it the wrong way. So, if our job is to protect the public health, and I would certainly submit that it is, WHO estimated that in the year 2000 there were 150,000 excess deaths a year due to climate change. 150,000 a year. And we are already affecting today health in many parts of the world, and that will only increase. And why we should care is that not only is it we who have to tell the public that there are health issues, but we also have to understand that many of the proposed solutions for climate change are healthy for everyone. So you would look at this as a win-win, and we should. But also, we have the appropriate skills. You know, we have had such good experience recently in some areas trying to provide media education, mass media education. Now, the star in the crown is the tobacco effort, tobacco control, where we know that mass media has had a big impact. But it's had a big impact in a lot of areas. In some medical areas having to do with control of cholesterol, high blood pressure, for example. It's not that it wasn't medical interventions, but it was letting people know how important this was and driving them in part to doctors. And we've had plenty of other efforts that combine regulatory and mass media approaches, such as seatbelts. Now, this is borrowed from Linda Rudolph, and these are the projective impacts of global temperature change. And you can see, let's just look row by row. In food, you can see as the temperature increases, we're going to have falling crop yields in many areas, particularly in developing parts of the world, the parts that need it most. The parts that where there's a high level of food insecurity and, frank, death from starvation. We may have, on the other hand, some rising yields in some high-latitude regions. I mean, some Canadians may be happy. But over time, we will also see falling yields in many developed areas as temperature continues to increase. And you can see where we are here, the relationship between the parts per million of CO2 and the temperature rise. Let's look at water. We see small mountain glaciers already starting to disappear. Water supplies are threatened in several areas, and once again, we're going to see big differences in different parts of our country. For example, we're going to see relative droughts in the southeast and the southwest, and we're going to see even in that area, look at the southeast and look at the effect of hurricanes from increased temperatures of the ocean. So the rains that we get are going to be more torrential. We're going to see that to some degree. We're going to see increased rainfall in the west, in the Midwest, and in the Northeast, in parts of the west anyway, the northern parts of the west. But it's also going to be harder to capture that rainfall because when it comes down too fast, you can't capture it for man-made uses. we're going to have significant declines in many areas, including the Mediterranean and southern Africa, and we're going to have sea level rise that threatens major cities. Which country is at greatest risk? United States. Which country is at greatest risk from rising sea levels?
Bangladesh.
I'll be surprised if in the year 2100 there is a Bangladesh. That's how bad it is. But we only have to look at the aerial photographs of the southeastern part of the United States, like New Orleans, and you look at what's happened to the buffers that they had for storms, and they have almost entirely disappeared. And you look at Galveston. Now, if it was a public policy matter, I hope there's nobody from Galveston in the audience, but the question would be, would you rebuild Galveston, knowing that you're going to have rising sea level? Would you rebuild New Orleans? Those are important questions. They have a lot of political issues associated with them. But just from a scientific base, you'd have to say the return on investment was questionable. Ecosystems. There is already extensive damage to coral reefs. I had the pleasure of going to the Great Barrier Reef recently and doing some diving. And the coral was not uniformly great. And people told me that 20 or 30 years ago it was. And you could see the deterioration in the coral from increasing water temperature. And it was very sad to see. I think that diving as a sport is going to go away in the relatively near future. That may not be the worst tragedy, but it does give you a sense of the destruction of a beautiful part of our environment. And we are going to have more and more species become extinct. And you can see that it grows perhaps even logarithmically with an increase in temperature. And that's both flora and fauna. We're going to have the extreme weather events, rising intensity of storms, rising intensity of forest fires, I'll come back to that, droughts, flooding, and heat waves. So we're going to have more and more public health and humanitarian disasters. And we're going to have, unfortunately, an increased risk of dangerous feedbacks and abrupt large-scale shifts in the climate system. I mean, the question is, where is the point of irreversibility? And that's a question of much discussion and grave concern. So here's another way, and if you could see this slide, which I obscured so you would have to take my word for it. But this is just another schematic, and it's not the best, I'm afraid. It's from Haynes and the JAMA 2004. But basically, it's kind of an analytic framework to look at what is occurring. And you have to. There's some things that are going to occur if you look at the bottom from changes in sea level that are going to have to do with the effects of storm and coastal flooding and the aquifer salinity, which, by the way, is an issue, in fact, in California. In the Sacramento Delta. But you're also going to see many changes in regional and local weather, and we've talked about that. Some of the changes are not a lot of fun. So, for example, you're going to see in many areas increased pollen production. How many of you would like to vote for increased pollen production? I'm not sure that's so we're going to see that is going to be a very serious problem. We're going to see an increase probably in the number of asthmatics. We are also going to see an increase in some infectious diseases, and I'll come back to that. Here, if you can see it again, the lights are on a little bright, but I think you can tell that there is the disease outbreaks occurring during El Nino in the 97 to 98 weather, and you can see that there was extreme weather. The yellow are the extremely dry areas, and the bluish gray, if you can see it, are the extremely wet areas. And what you do see is that there are big differences, but you also see that there are disease outbreaks. You have dengue fever, encephalitis, malaria, Rift Valley fever, hantavirus, cholera, and also some respiratory conditions from fire and smoke increase. So we had major health problems already associated with the microclimate changes in terms of temporal effects. These are short-term effects, but they have major health effects. Now, here's the effects of rising sea level. The coastal areas will become vulnerable to storms and flooding. Duh. No surprise there. We're going to lose, and we're already losing, coastal wetlands and erosion of many of the beaches. Saltwater contamination of drinking water is becoming a big problem in many areas, and we have potential damage to roads, highways, and other infrastructure near the coastal areas. Think about the Outer Banks. Think about Fire Island. Think about a lot of places. I don't know how long it'll take before there's a problem with Coronado, the wonderful place across the bridge, but, you know, everything is going to be threatened. And what we see in California, anyway, is a premature and rapid snowmelt in the Sierra snowpack, and that alters the timing of runoff water supplies for roughly one-half of our surface water. So what we have is the inability to capture a lot of the melt from that snowpack, and water is becoming increasingly scarce in California and in many other parts of the world. And, of course, with the 75 million increased number of people every year, the water problem is going to get exacerbated. I am very excited that APHA chose water as the subject for next year's meeting, because there's a lot to be said. Some of it relates to climate change, some doesn't, but it is a major problem worldwide. We have severe flooding now during spring and winter, slower water flow during summer seasons, and we have increased drought during the summer months. So we had in 2008, earlier this year, the governor declared a state drought, not surprisingly. We are projected to have an increase of between 62% and 88% in heat-related mortality by 2080. And it's not going to wait more than a few years. We're already seeing some impacts. We look, for example, at the health impacts after the onset of the heat waves that we've had recently, and we see extreme and prolonged heat exposure leading to heat cramps, heat exhaustion, heat stroke, heat syncope, and significant dehydration among people who are outside. And we have seen an increase in mortality and when we've had huge heat waves. It takes a while to see that because very few people on the death certificate say died of heat. But you find that they died of cardiovascular conditions that were exacerbated because they were in precarious balance in terms of their homeostasis with the increased heat making the difference. We saw in 1995, we saw the five-day heat wave in Chicago with 700 excess deaths, most attributable to the heat. And, of course, who can forget the European heat wave, particularly the stories we heard from Paris. And in total, there were 35,000 excess deaths. It's greater risk for people who don't have access to air conditioning, and not everybody can afford air conditioning. I know there are people who are debating between buying medicines and putting on their air conditioning. I mean, there is a real problem, and the problem is only going to get worse with the recession that we are likely to now be in. And for populations unaccustomed to the heat waves, people may have air conditioning but choose not to use it, not realizing the danger. I know of people in Los Angeles County who had air conditioning, and they were afraid to put it on because they were afraid they couldn't afford it, even though it was over 100 inside. Two vulnerable populations, of course, are the senior citizens. They're not quite old enough to be the emeriti, but almost. And anyway, that population is expected to increase by 83% by the year 2020. And of course, the other vulnerable group, as always, the result of inequities, is over 15% of LA County low SES residents with under 100% of federal poverty. We have 16%, one out of four kids lives in a family below the poverty level. Below the federal poverty level. Now, wildfires, I mean, it makes very good television, I will admit. I mean, people like to see fires on television, and why they like to watch them for so long, I don't know, but they apparently do, because when we had our wildfires, they suspended other coverage, and all you saw were different fires breaking out, and you see the firemen, and I guess, I don't know. But in any case, we've had problems of wildfires in Southern California since prehistoric times, and the Santa Ana winds drive heat waves, they prolong the wildfires, and they prevent wildlife control in this area. But the problem is the summer months are getting hotter, the summer is getting longer due to global warming. And what's associated with that is dry soil and vegetation. They are the fuels for the wildfires. And things are already getting worse in a perceptible way. Now here's the potential environmental impacts in Southern California of climate change on air quality. And what you see is you have an increase because of increased temperature and CO2 in formation of ground level ozone and the related smog. I don't know if any of you noticed who've been to LA that we occasionally have a little smog. There's increased allergen production, and there are also longer seasons. So those of you who have seasonal allergies, you can look forward to longer seasons. Senior citizens, children, and people with respiratory and chronic diseases, of course, are the most vulnerable to ozone and increased allergens, and we estimate a very substantial number of excess deaths in Los Angeles County from air pollution, and some of that is now secondary to this problem of climate change. But the health effects of high levels of ozone are reduced lung function, respiratory discomfort, and of course, exacerbation of chronic illnesses such as asthma, such as bronchitis, such as emphysema. Here is the estimate of the health impacts per year. One estimate of the premature deaths is 6,500 premature deaths a year, 9,000 excess hospitalization, 1.7 million respiratory illnesses, 1.3 million school absences, and 2.8 million lost workdays. So, anybody who's concerned about productivity, economic development during this time of recession might want to pay some attention to this. I'm sorry? This is the current burden. This is the current burden. There are different estimates. They go between 2,000 or 3,000 on one side and 6,500 on the other. But it's hard because, again, they don't say that they're due to. I haven't seen this. We are the folks that combine all the information on the death certificates on mortality, and you don't see air pollution on those death certificates. So there are a number of different statistical techniques we use to try and estimate that from the best available studies. But if you look at air pollution, it has a big impact because of, in part, diesel particulate matter. We have the Long Beach and the LA harbors. And these ports are major ports. They're 40% of all the goods that come into the country. And concentrated around the ports, rail yards, and heavily trafficked areas, we see premature deaths. We expect that there are higher rates of cancer. We see higher rates of respiratory disease, lost work days. So these are current problems. And it is for that reason that I say the time for an action is long since past. The scale is global. It touches everybody. And that is, of course, one of the problems that every country says, well, you know, if I do my part, how do I know you'll do yours? And that's one of the problems at the individual level. You know, it's one thing if somebody says, you know, you need to be tested for X, you need to have a mammogram, or you need to have a colonoscopy. Because you say, well, that's at least they're talking to me about something that affects me, and I can do something about it, and there's a clear result. When we talk about global warming, well, if I do this, what are the other 6.5 billion people on our planet going to do? How do I know that things that I would consider a sacrifice are going to be mirrored by what others do? It makes the sell much harder, except to people in public health. The intensity of the threat is such that it really does threaten all our basic survival mechanisms. Of course, it affects health, but it affects food, it affects water, and it affects shelter. You tell me what else is more important. And it is also an intersectoral issue. We have to engage every sector of society. If we're not, it's not a, this public health issue is too important to be left to people in public health. It needs people in transportation, in agriculture, in economic development, in tax policy, in energy policy. It needs all to get together on this issue. And here, as it was suggested from James Hansen, director of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, who says, we had at most 10 years, not 10 years to decide upon action, but 10 years to alter fundamentally the trajectory of global greenhouse emissions. There is still time, but just barely. So, how do we think about this? And this is from Howie Frumkin, who's been a real leader in these areas. Public health already, we already have a multi-level prevention approach. And we should use that and analogize that in terms of climate change. So on one hand, we have primary prevention, okay? And this is climate change mitigation. We want to stop or reduce climate change itself. So we have to slow or stabilize and hopefully over time reverse the climate change by reducing greenhouse gases, and that requires all the sectors, but particularly energy and transportation. But we also have the secondary and tertiary prevention, which is really an adaptation to climate change. So we have to prepare for and minimize the consequences. In emergency preparedness, we call it consequence management. We have to try and reduce the health burden. And similar to other preparedness, we have to be involved in these adaptation efforts, just like we are now worrying about pandemic influenza or bioterrorism. So what should we do? Okay, one thing we can do is to reduce energy use to reduce greenhouse gases and reduce, reuse, recycle. The three R's, everybody knows the three R's. I used to think it was reading, writing, and arithmetic, but now I realize it's reduce, reuse, and recycle. And we have to think about that individually. We are role models, whether for good or bad. If people in public health aren't modeling good behavior, who is going to? And then, of course, at the organizational level, that has to work. So that's the mitigation side. On the adaptation side, we have to prepare for it with emergency preparedness for wildfires, for droughts, for all kinds of problems. And as local health departments and as state health departments, we have to be prepared. And then, of course, we have to be the strongest advocates for healthy public policy. We have to think about what legislation is going to reduce greenhouse gases. I am very pleased that APHA has singled out for high priority attention, what bill? Don't all speak at once, it's too loud. The transportation bill that Congress is going to be looking at for reauthorization this year. What do we say? We have to look at public health, we have to look at transportation and energy. This is the big opportunity to try and affect what's in the transportation bill. A lot of it is national, some of it goes to states, some of it goes to large localities. If we don't have some impact here, it's going to be a long time before we have another opportunity. And we also have to sustain lifestyles and communities with practices that are ones that are as good today as they are 10 and 20 and 30 years from now. And most of us don't entirely live our lives that way. So here, looking at, this is again from Howie, did a wonderful job. If you look at these core public health functions, you can see that we have a lot of places of intersection. So let's look at the evaluation piece. We need to study and predict links between climate change and health. Then in terms of monitoring health, we need to track diseases related to climate change. We have a diagnosis and investigative function, investigate infectious water, food, and vector-borne outbreaks. Oops. We have to educate communities, and that's one of the areas where leadership is desperately needed. We have to mobilize partnerships. If we don't have the private sector, if we don't have business on this issue, it's going to be too late. We need faith-based organizations, we need businesses, we need healthcare professionals of every stripe. We need people who are head of voluntary organizations, the NGOs. We obviously need government at all levels, elected and appointed leaders. We need civic groups. And let me find this here now. Oops. Sorry. And then we need to develop policies. We need to develop response plans focusing on the most vulnerable. Now, one of the problems is when you try and slice and dice society, we wind up in Los Angeles County with at least several million people who are part of vulnerable populations. We have a population over 10 million, and at least 30% fit in one or more vulnerable categories. So it's not like you just have a few people you have to worry about. So we need different types of approaches to response to that kind of vulnerability. But we also need a public health workforce that is prepared to respond. We are not educated, and we do not necessarily have thought out well enough the plans for response. And then we're back to where we started. So that's the important issue. But what we have to also convey to others is that there are a lot of benefits of reducing greenhouse gases. People talk about sacrifice. Most of the discussion about the energy issue and transportation issue and greenhouse gases, we have to change. Now, is this supposed to be change we can believe in? Okay, a few of you are awake. But it has to be change that we think is going to also be on the positive side. When most people think change, other than the current campaign, they think, I'm going to have to do things that are hard for me. I'm going to have to do things that cost more. I'm going to have to do things I don't like. What we have to do is, and it's true, we're all creatures of inertia and creatures of habit, but there are co-benefits or ancillary benefits, and those are economic, social, environmental, public health, and these are independent of the direct benefits from mitigating climate change. For example, if a primary result for cleaner energy policy is reduced greenhouse gas emissions, but a co-benefit is less air pollution. If you have 3,000 to 6,000 deaths a year, excess deaths a year, and just in Los Angeles County that we could reduce, let's say it's only a couple thousand. If you could reduce, you have to do a lot of other things to reduce the number of deaths by 2,000 a year. So that's a real advantage. Here we have reducing vehicle miles traveled. This is the climate change response. If we can reduce the vehicle miles traveled, and by the way, I don't know if you've noticed, but one of the best mechanisms to reduce vehicle miles traveled has been reversed. Right? Right. Gasoline has plummeted down. The cost of a barrel of crude is down 50%. You know, I don't know what it is today, but it was on Friday around $66 or so. People had thought it was going to go to 150 when it was at 125, 130. So now prices are going down. So I expect to see those SUV ads again, you know, instead of the ads for this is the best economy vehicle in its class. We need, in one sense, high energy prices. We need high energy prices because that creates the incentive for investment. That has the incentives for less use. There were many tens of billions of miles less traveled due to the increased cost in energy, and that ain't bad. That's on the positive side of the ledger. But in addition to promoting cleaner energy production and cleaner fuels, which of course will cost more, we'll get, of course, reduced greenhouse gases, but we'll also get less air pollution. And we will get, in reducing vehicle miles traveled, higher physical activity rates. That means more people are going to use public transportation. Duh. There'll be more investment in public transportation. People will use it. How many of you use public transportation almost every day? That's almost a quarter. That's great. Some of us living in, I could get from where I live to my office with public transportation. It's just I'm not sure I could get there by the time it closed. Okay. Here are key mitigation technologies and practices. In terms of transport, we have fuel efficiency, we have hybrids. How many of you own a fuel efficient or hybrid car? Okay, about maybe 40%. Road to rail, moving to rapid transit instead of taking single occupancy trips. Public transport is critical. These the ones in green have health co-benefits. Public transport, more physical activity. Non-motorized transport, the same. And land use planning, again, increased physical activity and reduced respiratory illnesses. Building, daylighting. What does daylighting mean? Yeah, real windows for real people. Using natural light to the greatest degree possible. Energy efficiency, improved cook stoves, solar heating and cooling. On the agriculture side, we need livestock and manure management. You know, the contribution of livestock to global warming is significant, and nowhere more significant in this country where we have very high consumption of meat products. I'll come back to that in a minute. We need to improve our use of nitrogen-based fertilizer. And then at the industry side, energy efficiency, heat and power recovery. There are more and more tools to recover energy that is now being lost. And energy supply, coal gasification, nuclear power is very contentious, but that is one of the options. And renewable energy. And most people that I know and respect most in the field of energy say it's not a question of choosing wind or choosing coal gasification or trying to find or using geothermal or using nuclear. They say we have to use all of those now. Okay. Now, globally, the ancillary benefits may be 30 to 100% of abatement costs. That is good news. And we think that the knock-on, the health, public health improvement and knock-on effects to health services for reductions in air pollution account for about 80% of the total value of ancillary benefits in the U.S. In Canada, they estimated that the proposed emission reductions would also reduce SO2 by 9%, nitrogen oxides by 7% of annual emissions, and that they could avoid 3,300 premature deaths per year. In Canada. That's Canada's roughly the population of California. And greenhouse gas reduction in four cities would avoid, through 2020, 64,000 premature deaths, 65 cases of chronic bronchitis, and 37 million person days of restricted activity. So here are all the reductions. Here are the increases. Remember, there's an increase in social capital. And I would also say there might be a reduction in traffic injuries. You know, anybody have looked at the data on in California now? We have to be hands-free. You can't drive like this. Or if you can, you better have something other than a phone in your hand. But there are studies that suggest that even if you're hands-free, that driving while talking on a cell phone is equivalent to driving with a blood alcohol concentration of 0.08, which is the legal limit. So one advantage of taking public transportation would probably be a reduction in motor vehicle injury and deaths. But we would see reductions in so many areas: respiratory disease, traffic, heart disease, depression. Social capital, increased social interaction, reduces the incidence of depression. Osteoporosis, which of course occurs because people in general are not active enough. Diabetes, cancer, and stress. All these are benefits, public health benefits, of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So now let's just talk very briefly about meat. Our average American diet requires the production of an extra 1.2 of CO2s compared to a strictly vegetarian diet. And we're talking about 2.2 pounds of beef is equivalent to the emission CO2 of 155 miles of driving with average miles per gallon. If meat consumption by 20%, if everybody did it, it would be the equivalent of everybody going from a Camry to a Prius. So that gives you a sense. And you'd also see reduction, if you had a reduction in meat of greenhouse gas emissions, you'd have reduction in antibiotic use, which is very common in livestock. We'd have less water pollution. You noticed what happened in North Carolina, for example, with that incredible problem when they had, because of all the pigs and they had all the rain and the combination was not good. And I won't describe it. Air pollution will be reduced. Soil erosion, which is a major issue associated with the way we're using that land, is a real problem. Unsustainable water consumption and we'd have decreased pesticide use. We would also have greater food security, biodiversity, protein intake, rural community strength, and reduction in food costs. We would see a reduction in heart disease, obesity, colorectal cancer, breast and prostate cancers, type 2 diabetes, antibiotic resistance, respiratory disease, and pesticide health effects. Now, if that isn't enough to make people decide that this is an important health issue, then we are not being very effective in our communication skills. And so I'm very interested in seeing Ed Maybach's presentation that we can all use with the APHA imprimatur to give to health professionals, not just public health professionals, and perhaps even to other constituencies to help them understand the immediacy of this issue. Okay, what can we do in our homes? Recycling, place of member of the three R's, recycling programs in the workplace and home. We could recycle half of our household waste, would lead to hundreds of pounds of CO2 saved every year. We can promote energy efficiency, putting all those compact fluorescent bulbs, and then we have to figure out how to dispose of the mercury. But that also is very useful. We can make small energy changes on a broad scale, reducing light bulbs with energy-efficient light bulbs in all county buildings. How about the shopping bags? How about the production of all those plastic bags, which have all kinds of other terrible environmental effects, but use, in fact, petroleum products? And we can encourage renewable power sources like solar and wind. How many of you have solar or wind power at home? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, there's probably some room for improvement there. Also, turning off your TV, your computer, and other electronics. I mean, I have two kids, and you'd think that screens had to be on all the time. You know, we need something that automatically turns them off, and we could save huge amounts. Try and drive less and walk more. Fewer car trips in the neighborhood. And of course, this gets in the long term to urban planning. If you think about this issue, we need some things that are short term. I mean, you can change a bulb and you can make a difference today. You can buy a car, you know, in the short to intermediate term that does much better in terms of CO2 emissions, and you can make a difference. If we want to change the urban landscape and not have cul-de-sacs so people don't have to walk a mile to go, you know, what should be 1,000 feet, that's going to take decades, but we need to start now. So urban redesign, infill housing, a whole bunch of things are really important, but they're going to take time. So we need to think of short-term things, because those are the things that get politicians really excited, intermediate-term benefits, and then the long-term benefits. And we need a balanced portfolio. So, So one of the things we can do is provide incentives for employees to purchase fuel-efficient vehicles. How many of you work for employers that do that? Los Angeles County does. Every gallon of gas saved is tens of pounds of CO2 saved. And if you take a car, maintain it. Just inflated tires properly can improve gas mileage by 3%. Now, emergency preparedness. We know, at least in Los Angeles, that there are going to be heat waves and wildfires. In the Southeast, you know you've had terrible devastation from hurricanes. We know in the Midwest and down in the Panhandle there are tornadoes. There are all kinds of problems, and we need to prepare ourselves as individuals and as health agencies. So, and then finally, we need to support healthy policies. Support policies related to sustainable communities, mixed-use development, jobs near housing, transit-oriented design, bike lanes and sidewalks, parks and green. Sounds simple, doesn't it? I can tell you that in our department, we have a group that works exclusively on those issues and works strongly with regional planning. How many of you are from health departments? And keep your hands up. And how many of you that are in health departments have an activity that is directly related to land use and works with regional planning and works with other partners at the local level to try and change urban design? Okay, almost everybody. Well, that's good. That's really good news. Anyway, we need also to have public transportation, the green buildings, the LEED certification. How many of you are familiar with the LEED program? Good. That's about half. We need recycling, waste management, pollution control, and the securing of safe water supplies. More about that next year. And they have to occur at every level of government. One of the things that we've done in our department is to try and start institutionalizing health impact assessment. How many of you are familiar with health impact assessment? Okay, about 30-35%. Well, these are ways of trying to assess the health benefits or adverse health effects of policies or programs in other sectors. So if one says to you, for example, what are the health benefits of making this area more walkable for school, or putting in a bike trail, or changing the incentives for farmers in the Midwest to grow corn and sell it for biodiesel, or increasing mass transit by a certain amount? Well, health impact assessment quantifies the health benefits and the costs in terms of adverse effects. And so people who are making decisions, for example, in energy and transportation and agriculture and fiscal and monetary policy, can realize that they're making health decisions. They're not just making energy decisions or transportation decisions or tax decisions. They are making health decisions. We need to let them know that they have choice of being on the side of health or being on the other side. And health is not the only consideration when you're dealing with an energy bill or you're dealing with economic development, but it should be part of the mix. And our role in public health is to provide them that information. So the kind of information we need is to give them stuff that tells them in health impact assessment how to do that. And what should we do? Okay, this is again from Linda Rudolph, and nice list. Educate ourselves. I hope that this session will help you to some degree. Partnerships and collaboration. I want to reemphasize that this is too important to be left to public health. Say it again. If you don't have partnerships and collaboration, we get nowhere on this issue. It's too big an issue. It's an international issue. It's a cross-sectoral issue. Lend public health credibility and experience in driving policy and behavior change. All of us in public health are viewed as experts. We know more about public health than 99% of the people we come in contact with, unless, of course, we have a narrow social circle. And we have a voice of authority, and we will be respected. We need to give people, put our prestige on the line about this issue. We need to advocate for aggressive government and business mitigation policies and strategies. And I mean aggressive, not tiny tweaks, but aggressive. We need to advocate also for personal, organizational, local government carbon footprint reduction. How many of you have looked at your carbon footprint? Okay, well, that's about 25%. That's something I would recommend that all of you do and become familiar with that technology, because that helps you to understand where you are with respect to others, but helps you educate others so that they can educate themselves about their own behaviors, not about somebody else. Make it real personal, upfront and personal. Increase understanding and research about the health co-benefits. People are only thinking about change in terms of what is it going to make me do that I don't want to do. Think about change as having a lot of positive health benefits. Ensure that the health co-benefits are included in policy and cost analysis, such as using health impact assessments. Protect vulnerable populations. You have to advocate for equity in terms of the mitigation. It's a social justice issue. We also need to monitor the health impacts of climate change so we can keep talking about what's going on locally. We need a forecasting model that says, in this town, here are some of the effects we're going to see. and here's the likelihood we're going to see them in this period of time and that period of time. We didn't have time to talk about it, but some of the changes in climate, we could wind up in San Diego with dengue fever and malaria in the near future. Well, people don't really know that. And, you know, they're going to be worried. Well, okay, what can you do about it? It leads to the discussion, what can we do about climate change? And then, of course, preparing and adapting. We have to be prepared for the consequences because we're not going to stop them all no matter what we do now. And we can't do it alone. We have to tell people that the co-benefits are great, that it's a moral obligation. This is about a moral obligation, but it's also about our kids and their kids. You know, one of the benefits, I hope, of the terrible economic downturn, which is so adversely affecting so many people, is that I hope people will not be defining themselves based on their personal balance sheet, based on what assets they have, based on their wealth. That maybe we can get back to talking about kind of defining yourself based on your values. And it's that values discussion that I hope can lead people to understand it is our obligation. And even people who don't care about themselves care a lot about their kids and their grandkids and future generations, their progeny. So that's the sweet spot, and we need to focus on it. And with that, I will end and leave time for questions or comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jonathan. Unfortunately, this presentation has been in the making up until like yesterday. So we don't have copies of this presentation available to distribute. And I'm sure many of you would like very much to have a copy of. There were lots of facts and figures that were thrown out that it's impossible to copy all down. Is it possible, Jonathan?
I'll put it on our website.
There you go. So that it will be available.
It'll be on the Los Angeles. I'll put it on the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health website, and you'll have a very easy. There's a lot of different ways to get there. LAPublicHealth.org. But if you just put Los Angeles County Public Health, it'll take you right to it. And I'll make a call right after this and make sure that it's up by tomorrow.
Can't do better than that. Now the questions. I'm sure there are lots of them. Let's start with anyone.
The impact of the Kyoto Treaty, what if the U.S. signs on to that? What will that mean?
Kyoto Treaty.
Well, there are probably other people here that can answer that better than I. I think it's, again, a question first of moral obligation. How quickly the impact will be felt depends on how it's interpreted and how our responsibility is interpreted. And there are a lot of different ways to get there. You know, in California, there's been a commitment made by our governor to roll back pollution. I'm hopeful that the next administration will support aggressive policies consistent with our obligations under a Kyoto Treaty. But, of course, that remains to be seen.
Other questions?
You alluded to it in your talk, Jonathan, but then you said nothing about it thereafter, and that is population control on a worldwide basis. That's going to be somewhere up around number one if we have to take this problem seriously.
Yeah, it's number one for a whole bunch of different reasons, and it'll be number one again when we talk about water next year. But the population growth, you know, even if you're not a Malthusian, population growth is a poison in terms of what it does to the carrying capacity of the Earth. And I think that there needs to be greater recognition of this. The problem is that it is viewed by developing countries those developed countries that are not growing very rapidly except by immigration. In a few cases, trying to tell the others what to do. And only China has really tried to do that. So it is politically not popular. And I am not sure how one's going to get the economic will, the political will of enough nations to make that a loud voice, even though it has to be. I'm open to interest to those of you who think you understand that perhaps better than I, but I've looked at it. I gave a talk, in fact, when I got the Sedgwick Medal about population growth and what the impacts are, even if nothing else happened. And it is devastating. And we need to have, you know, there are a number of countries that are going through the demographic transition, and that augurs well for some reduction in the rate of growth. But again, you're starting with a rate of growth from a larger number. I'm hopeful that the demographic transition and other pressures, social security systems, for example, being developed in some countries, will lead to a policy that reduces growth, just as we've seen in the OECD and the other OECD countries, some of which have negative population growth. I don't have a good answer.
Go. You said that it's the local health department's responsibility to prepare for adaptation for response to heat emergencies and smoke, et cetera. But I think it's something that APHA and national organizations can advocate for to get CDC and Homeland Security to explicitly include climate change adaptation as part of our emergency preparedness.
Well, I think that's a very good point. I think that these days most health departments are taking an all-hazards approach in any case, and I think that we've been relatively successful in getting that adopted. The understanding is that you can't just prepare for pan flu or bioterrorism or radiologic terror. I mean, you have to focus on both the man-made and the terrible man-induced emergencies. So I think it would be nice to have it explicit. I'm not sure in our case it would change very much because we've taken the approach of all hazards, and I think most health departments have.
Sadly, the people, and stop me if you said this or stop me if you heard this, but sadly, the people that will suffer the most from the effects of global climate change are the very people that we kind of think about or talk about when we're talking about population, I don't like to say control, population change, population limitation, something. Whereas our carbon footprints are so huge that each American child that's born, at least classically, is much more responsible for the changes that are occurring on the planet that are we call global climate change. And those people over there that are suffering, especially live along the coastal plains, are going to be the first to suffer, the worst to suffer. And their populations will probably be decimated by the effects of global climate change. So I think we should keep that in mind when we're talking about population control or population mitigation.
Yes, there's a major social justice issue there, an equity issue. But the other effect is that population effects are not just on greenhouse gases. I mean, you have impacts in terms of agriculture, you have impacts in terms of water, which are independent of the carbon footprint. Not entirely, but at least partially independent of the carbon footprint. And so I think there are reasons to be concerned about population growth. But on the other hand, I hope nobody would advocate a policy that says, well, the population will take care of itself, you know, because we're going to have devastation in those areas with the fastest growth.
Can I just hang on to that comment? As you mentioned earlier, the effect of livestock production, I recently wrote an article on vegetarianism and was required to cut out the whole environmental part of it because it's considered too political. And I'll talk to you about it later.
Okay.
The best source that I found, if you didn't mention this earlier, is the FAO report that came out, I think, 2 years ago. If you read just the executive summary, you'll be further astounded by the effects of livestock production worldwide than you have been already just hearing Dr. Fielding's brief comments about it. FAO 2006.
Yeah, livestock have a huge impact. I mean, a really disproportionate impact in developed countries. I think one question here and then one back there. Yes.
Yeah, thank you for a great presentation. Reggie Bontia from PolicyLink. I just wanted to actually build off of the last comment that was made, even right here in the
nice and loud so everybody can hear you.
Even right here in the U.S., there are data to show that the groups that are going to be most impacted by climate change, low-income communities, communities of color, have actually contributed least to it. We think about consumption patterns and whatnot. So it's important to think about that when we develop mitigation and adaptation strategies, that we're not developing strategies that are going to even more disproportionately affect communities that haven't impacted, or that mitigation strategies, such as congestion pricing or gasoline taxes, aren't regressive. And also to keep in mind that right here in the U.S., of course, on the global scale.
Gentleman in the back.
Given the worldwide scope of this particular problem, is it reasonable to assume that maybe this could and should be an issue on the United Nations agenda? And even if it were, could we reasonably expect something constructive to come there from?
Well, this is beyond my level of comprehension in terms of the potential. I do agree, it has been. I mean, there have been reports coming out from the UN, and it is an issue in the UN. Whether it is interdigitated enough between the different parts of the UN, others who are closer to it would have to opine. I think this is, you know, if this is a body that is going to really develop in some structured way global cooperation, there's never been a better opportunity than global warming. Whether the relationships are such that that's possible, I don't know. Yes, sir.
Really, you hit on a number of points. The animal thing is a big one, and this is one that public health could make a big impact on, and yet we don't very much. We stress the need for protein in diet, we stress the need in the food groups, et cetera, and yet we know that high fat products cause heart disease and all kinds of things like that. We're not doing near enough on nutrition to help people realize that they can get by with less protein, and because we're overdoing the protein right now. We're way over what we need to be. So that's one area that the health education should make a big difference in. And then the second area, you know, we're looking at China in, on the one sense, saying they're going to be making a bigger mess than we are in a few years, and so what's the use? But the reality is that they're in the process right now of building more than 100 nuclear power plants that are safe. And what are we doing? We're still burning coal because our environmental concerns are so worried. We won't touch nuclear, where nobody's ever died from it, and yet all of this coal air pollution is killing thousands of people. So we need to re-educate the environmentalists too about what really is dangerous to our environment.
Thank you. Very, very thoughtful comment.
I'd like to make a plug for the National Center for Environmental Health and Energy Disease Control, where they have no direct relation. So, no self-interest in this comment.
No relationships? Oh, gosh.
Close whatsoever. Some colleagues of mine at Environmental Defense and NATO and I did a survey of local public health department directors. John Lee Duncan Fielding is one of our respondents. We found that of the 200 and some local public health departments across the U.S., local public health department director survey, 60%, give or take, believe they were already seeing climate-related health impacts in their communities. 75%, give or take, felt that they would be seeing more severe climate-related health impacts within the next decade. Approximately 10% were doing anything about it, and the reason being, they don't know what to do. They don't have the resources to take action. So the reason I'm making a plug for the National Center for Environmental Health is this is a very high priority of CDC's. They also don't have the resources to help state and local public health departments respond to this modern plague. So this is something that my federal representatives have heard from me on multiple occasions, that CDC needs these resources.
Yes, just to build on that, I fully concur. It would be so helpful to have a forecasting model that then everybody could adapt to their local circumstances, and that's the place to do it. But there is not any funding to do that or a number of other needed tools that could be useful to local communities everywhere. think we have time for one or two more questions. Yes, sir. The question is there any relationship between seismic activity and climate change? I'm just not aware of that literature. So unfortunately, you're talking to somebody who's pretty dumb on that subject.
There's a heat connection. There's a
heat-related connection. There is. Okay, so why don't you talk to... I've heard from seismologists that they think there's a relationship. I just don't know the literature. You know, if you heat the Earth to a greater degree, you can expect that those plates might increase the tendency to, you know, to fall across one another. But I don't know that literature. I don't want to give you any suggestion that I do. Last question. I think they're back there.
I don't have the scientific background, but my question is this week, you know, we advocate for people to have more physical exercise, walk more. But we have to convince them of that. And I wonder if there's any subset of studies that talk about time, distance, and money. I live in the middle of Washington, D.C., and I live about 2 miles from work, and I walk every day. I have 2 blocks from the subway, which I can take, but the subway costs $1.50 or $2. And also, even if I take the subway, I time it, meticulous with that timing thing, and I can walk from my apartment to my office. I work for APJ. And I can do that in less time than it takes me to go to the subway, go down, go back, and get to my office, or to go to the garage and get the car. And I tell people to walk all the time because not only save the environment, they'll save time and money. It costs no money for me to walk if I don't have bad knees or bad back. So are there subset studies that say you'll save time, it will take you less time to walk, you'll be healthier, you'll save some money, and get people. I stopped people who are waiting for the shuttle bus to go 4 blocks to the convention center, and I sit there and I tell them, you're going to wait 5 minutes for the shuttle bus, and then you're going to have to make 3 stops and leave to the convention center. Why don't you just walk right down there?
Well, I think the answer is very simple. Everybody needs to work for APHA, and you need to be cloned.
Thank you, Dr. Fielding, very much.